From Feature Story News in Washington, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. The stage is set here for President Obama's speech tonight outlining his strategy for defeating Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. Today on the program, an extended interview with a man who is no stranger to the high stakes the U.S. faces. The former commander of CENTCOM, General Anthony Zinni, tells us it's high time for the president to act.
The immediate task is to get him out of Iraq. We've waited too long. I think they've been in there now 3 months or so, and we're still diddling around looking for a strategy and looking for coalition partners. To use an analogy, you got to shoot the wolf on the sled before you worry about the ones in the wood line and what your strategy is. And we've been, I think, too slow in dealing with this.
That's General Anthony Zinni, ahead of Barack Obama's White House address, after our summary of Wednesday's main news.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. U.S. President Barack Obama is preparing to unveil plans to target Islamic State militants in Syria. He will unveil a framework strategy expected to include airstrikes combined with the arming of so-called moderates. From Washington, Daniel Wrenches reports.
President Barack Obama is expected to propose airstrikes on the Islamic State militants in Syria for the first time during his address to the nation, and to call on Congress to allocate $500 million to train and arm rebel fighters considered moderates in Syria. The strategy is also likely to include an increase in air support in Iraq, where U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has been meeting with the new Iraqi Prime Minister, Haider al-Abadi.
As I told you, the president will lay out tonight a more detailed description of exactly what the United States is prepared to do together with many other countries.
A military move on Syria would be considered a dramatic escalation for a U.S. president who's consistently spoken of the need to reduce military commitments in the Middle East.
European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker has given both France and the U.K. key roles in the new 28-member group. The UK is in charge of overseeing financial services, with Jonathan Hill, ex-leader of the House of Lords, filling the role. And former French finance minister Pierre Moscovici is to head EU economic policy. Jean-Claude Juncker says the new appointments will help give Europe a new start. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko says he's willing to give pro-Moscow separatists more autonomy in order to keep the eastern regions part of Ukraine. He pledged to bring a bill to parliament soon to offer the rebels greater power. Mr. Poroshenko said it's crucial the country remain in one piece and said the ceasefire between the rebels and the Ukrainian government is helping despite violations. However, representatives for the separatists say they will not be satisfied until they gain full independence from Kiev. British Prime Minister David Cameron says it would break his heart if Scotland voted to become independent. He's been visiting Scotland ahead of a vote next week on whether it should leave the UK. Ollie Barrett has this report.
Polls show a tight race, hence Mr. Cameron's desperate visit to Scotland to campaign in favour of keeping the United Kingdom together.
I would be heartbroken if this family of nations that we've put together and that we've done such amazing things together, if this family of nations was torn apart.
Also in Scotland, his Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg and leader of the opposition Labour Party Ed Miliband. But Alex Salmond, Scotland's First Minister and leader of the Yes campaign for independence, says his opponents from London can't be trusted. The independence referendum is next Thursday, and David Cameron insists if Scots do vote to leave the UK, there is no going back.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. In less than 24 hours, South African Paralympian Oscar Pistorius will know the outcome of the trial in which he was accused of intentionally killing his girlfriend Riva Steenkamp. Mr. Pistorius has maintained his innocence throughout the six-month-long trial, saying he mistook Ms. Steenkamp for an intruder in their home. Gary Alfonso reports from South Africa.
The Pistorius family, Riva Steenkamp's parents, and scores of local and international media are expected to crowd the Pretoria High Court when Judge Thokozile Masipa starts delivering her verdict. Legal experts are divided over whether the prosecution succeeded in proving that Pistorius intended to kill his girlfriend or whether the defense succeeded in proving it was an accident. Under South African law, the judge could rule that Pistorius intended to kill someone when he fired at the door, which could also carry a long prison sentence. If found guilty, guilty of murder, Pistorius' defense has already indicated they would appeal.
And dozens of websites, including Netflix, Twitter, and Reddit, are showing their support for net neutrality with a symbolic slowdown. Concerns are mounting that proposed new regulations in the United States could lead to broadband providers demanding extra fees for fast internet. Rebecca Bowring reports from San Francisco.
Vimeo, Etsy, Mozilla, and the rest of the coalition of popular websites aren't really slowing down. They're displaying the spinning, still loading wheel to protest controversial proposed changes to net neutrality. That's the idea that all internet data should be treated in the same way, regardless of its content or origin. The US Federal Communications Commission, or FCC, is considering allowing broadband providers to charge certain web firms such as Netflix for guaranteed fast access lanes to consumers. Opponents say that would create a two-tier internet, with paying companies delivering content quickly and non-payers crawling through the system. Silicon Valley firms have warned the move could stifle innovation.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports. At the White House, officials are spending the day laying the groundwork for the president's address to the nation tonight, in which he will lay out his strategy for degrading and ultimately destroying the militant group Islamic State. The speech comes just a matter of days after President Obama conceded he hadn't finalized his planning, certainly as far as the militants operating on the Syrian side of the border was concerned. Today, White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest offered this curtain raiser ahead of the speech.
The president will lay out what he clearly sees as American interests in this situation. He'll talk about the risks that the United States faces, and he'll talk about the strategy that he has put together to confront those risks.
Among those eagerly awaiting the president's address, a man who has emerged as one of his toughest critics. General Anthony Zinni is the former commander of CENTCOM, and he's written a new book about his experiences. It's called Before the First Shots Are Fired: How America Can Win or Lose Off the Battlefield. And yesterday, he visited our studios here in Washington and spoke to FSN's Lorna Shaddock.
Well, I think in many ways what we see today is a product of the way we mishandled the reaction to 9/11. I thought after 9/11 we should have been totally focused on al-Qaeda and al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. Iraq was a distraction, and unfortunately it became a priority. We did it badly. I had just left command of U.S. Central Command, and the plan we left in place was for 380,000 troops if you were to go into Iraq. Not just to take down the regime, but you know, we knew it would be an occupation. You had to seal the borders, control the population, make sure you bring order. We even had a plan not to disband the Iraqi military, which we thought was key, vet the leadership. So the way it was handled was disastrous. It was done on the cheap, thinking flowers in the street, liberation. That didn't happen. So bad things came across the border, and obviously, the internal feud between Shia and Sunni and Kurds and Arabs and everything really took hold, and I think was the breeding ground for what we have now. And in al-Qaeda, we again tried to do it on the cheap. We had the Rena Army, the Northern Alliance, which allowed al-Qaeda to get away out of Tora Bora. So sort of lack of following the Powell Doctrine of overwhelming force, freeze the situation, deal with it quickly, and then that gives you time and space to resolve it. And we ended up dragging this out. You know, then we had to do the surge, and you know, then we got into counterinsurgency, into nation building. Meanwhile, al-Qaeda, you know, sort of left the scene, went into Pakistan, then sort of metastasized into Boko Haram and Abu Sayyaf and all these other sort of satellite groups. It sort of like mercury when you put your finger on it. And now we see ISIS, which is sort of a offshoot of al-Qaeda in Iraq, found a sanctuary in Syria as the civil war started, and now is back in Iraq. You know, so I think it is a product of the mishandling of how we should have reacted to 9/11.
So do you think that the decision to go into Iraq directly relates now to what we're seeing in terms of ISIS? Or I mean, some might argue that it could have happened anyway. Saddam Hussein may well have been toppled in an Arab Spring kind of a moment. So it might not necessarily be directly linked. There could have been other factors anyway.
Yeah, it's hard to say what might have happened, but we know for sure that a weakened Iraq, the aftermath of our intervention, certainly left it vulnerable. And I think our belief, for example, that the Anbar awakening and the Sunni awakening and all this really meant there was significant change. I was in Iraq and did an assessment right after Maliki came into office. And everybody I talked to in the U.S. Embassy, our generals that were there, and even the ministers and the ministries I went to in the Iraqi government, all said if Maliki doesn't create an inclusive government, particularly with the Sunnis, and they don't feel that they're involved in the decision-making, share in the resources in a fair way, have a voice in government, if all the power is centralized in Baghdad, and if Maliki is seen as a puppet of the Iranians and it's basically a Shia government, it's going to fail. So I don't believe any amount of security assistance, equipping, and training would have made a difference if to the Sunnis they didn't feel part of Iraq, and that was the case. And that sort of added to the, I think, the vulnerability and allowed ISIS to come in.
From where you were as head of CENTCOM, where do you think, in terms of strategy now, the world of anti-terror is, as opposed to where it was just after 9/11? How should strategy evolve, and how has it evolved, and how should it continue to evolve?
Well, first of all, I think the threat now has become more dangerous because it's more global. It's more diversified, it's more independent, it's not monolithic. You know, they have sort of loose ties, but they stand on their own. You've seen for the first time here now in ISIS, they've actually seized ground and are claiming a state, although I don't put much stock in that. But they've moved to the gates of Baghdad. They're very dangerous. Not that I think they could necessarily take Baghdad, but they can get in there and certainly raise havoc and destabilize the what remains of the Iraqi state if they were to get in. So there's an immediate threat that's unlike what we've seen before. I think it's a much greater threat than we saw prior to 9/11 or right before 9/11. So the immediate task is to get them out of Iraq. We've waited too long. I think they've been in there now 3 months or so, and we're still diddling around looking for a strategy and looking for coalition partners. To use an analogy, you got to shoot the wolf on the sled before you worry about the ones in the wood line and what your strategy is. And we've been, I think, too slow in dealing with this. We're starting to get going now with air attacks and special operations forces on the ground and that sort of thing. The Iraqi army's getting a little bit more backbone. The Peshmerga will fight. We're providing support for them. Maliki's gone, so there's hope that a new government might be more inclusive. So if you drive ISIS out, at least the people will have something to fall back on and not be at least fearful or apathetic or even support ISIS. I think we need to build two coalitions. One is a coalition, probably of mainly European countries and others that would contribute and support in some way to defeating ISIS, and a regional coalition, much like we did in the first Gulf War. And the regional coalition was under Prince Khalid. I think key are Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states, Jordan, Turkey, that really need to bolster this. And then I think we need to strike inside Syria because, if ISIS falls back, one lesson we should have learned about the terrorists, don't give them a sanctuary. Afghanistan was a sanctuary for al-Qaeda. We saw what happened. And, ISIS now has a sanctuary in Syria. That you cannot have sanctuary stand. These groups will just grow, they'll recruit more, they'll become a greater threat, and eventually they can, because of the nature of the globalized world we live in, reach out and touch everybody.
So that then raises two questions for me. First of all, the idea of this coalition, which sounds great, and we've heard certainly on paper a lot of European nations have been supportive, Middle Eastern nations as well. But in reality, when it comes to it, how many of those will really want to commit energy, resources, even potentially troops, to something like that? Can President Obama really bring something like that together?
Well, this is a test of our leadership. In many ways, I think this is what Putin is doing, testing how strong is American leadership, particularly in Europe and NATO, and then how strong is European resolve and commitment and cohesion. So in one way, that's being tested through Ukraine, and in other ways, it's being tested with ISIS. I was expecting out of the Cardiff meetings in Wales with NATO, I was expecting a much stronger statement on ISIS. I think they probably were okay in what they said about the Ukraine. But 28 nations, I didn't hear this NATO, 28 nations, I heard maybe nine others will contribute in some form. And the kinds of things I heard from the leadership out there was, well, we support American airstrikes. I didn't see that they were going to fly with us. Ground troops are always the toughest, and I think it shows a lack of understanding of the military. You could put two brigades of U.S. or U.S. British or whatever on the ground right now, and you would drive ISIS right out of Iraq. We did this when Saddam brutalized the Kurds. I was involved in Operation Provide Comfort. The UK had a brigade there. The French had a brigade. We had 13 nations contribute. We pushed the Iraqi army out of Kurdistan, brought the Kurds back home. Then we withdrew. There was no quagmire. There was no getting stuck, mission creep. We enforced the no-fly zones, and the Saudis and the Kuwaitis and others contributed to paying for that, used their bases. And we kept the situation stable for 10 years before the incursion in Iraq destabilized that. And we did it with less troops and report to the Pentagon for work every day.
Well, that brings me to the second question I had with that strategy, which is when it comes to Syria, unfortunately, this is likely to be a whole different ballgame, right? Mm-hmm. Because of the situation the way it is now, committing any kind of military resources, even if it's airstrikes rather than on the ground, is a whole different ballgame.
Yes.
And presumably also would require, at the very least, some kind of vote in Congress as well.
Oh, yes. Well, first of all, the president, by the War Powers Act, can't go beyond 60 days without going to Congress and getting approval. I talked very carefully about removing them from Iraq. And then I think airstrikes or whatever you need in Syria. I certainly don't see an incursion or invasion. No one's going to be up for that. But they can't have a free rein, and you know, much like we did in Iraq through air power and enforcing it, you will certainly reduce their conventional capability, which they managed to grab from the Iraqis and not make them a threat to their neighbors. And by striking them, you could also give an advantage to the Free Syria movement, the more moderates that might be willing to engage them. So if there's some resolution of the Syrian, I tend to think right now Syria is going to be split. I tend to think the Alawites and the Christians aren't going to be dislodged, and they're going to have a piece of Syria. What happens to that eastern piece, yet to be determined. But there's going to be some kind of divide in the end. I think it's in our interest to make sure if that occurs, there are moderates that are influential.
So clearly there is a lot of concern, not just from President Obama, but from allies as well, about ground troops. Do you think, is there a direct link between what happens in Iraq in 2003 and that concern about ground troops? And if so, would things be different if we hadn't gone into Iraq? He'd be able to send in, as you said, a couple of brigades now, hit the problem on the head, and that would be the end of it.
Well, the irony is the Powell Doctrine, Colin Powell, Caspar Weinberger, former Secretary of Defense, both put out what were called the Powell and Weinberger Doctrines. It said, deal with everything with overwhelming force. You paralyze the situation, you control it, you can get things done quicker. It's actually less cost in terms of casualties and treasure in the long run. The first Gulf War was a good example of this. We did it with overwhelming force, ended it in a matter of hours, in what we needed to do, which was expel Saddam from Kuwait, and then get him under control. By trying to do both Iraq and Afghanistan on the cheap this time, shock and awe, just a few troops, run up to Baghdad, Afghanistan, again, sell out to the Northern Alliance, which let us down. By not using overwhelming force, particularly ground forces, we created a long-term sort of miring into a situation with mission creep, get in the nation building. Unfortunately, the lesson that was drawn out of that is no boots on the ground. The lesson that should have been drawn, follow the Powell Doctrine, use overwhelming force on the ground right away. It can shorten what you need to do. It can resolve the situation, at least make it, to use the president's term, manageable in some form fairly quickly. You don't get an advantage by trying to incrementally commit troops and then limiting yourself and then telling your enemy what you won't do. I will not commit ground troops. Oh, well, you're just giving them an advantage. So it doesn't make strategic sense.
But I'm just assuming post 9/11 and post Iraq war, there's not, even if that does make strategic sense, public opinion for President Obama or whoever would have been president now is just not behind that kind of an operation.
Well, I think we make too much of that. I just read in the paper this morning, the public opinion is beginning to turn. One more beheading of an American tourist or journalist, and what do you think? Presidents shouldn't be constantly putting their finger up testing the political will. The best example was Ronald Reagan. Right after the Beirut bombings, heavy criticism, no mission, troops left to hang out, he was faced with Grenada. And all the political advice he had was do not go into Grenada. The American people won't support it. They're not in a mood. Beirut is, you know, is still sticking with him. Reagan asked one question. Is there a potential that American lives could be at risk here? And the answer he was given is yes, because the medical students, possibly. He said, then there's no debate. You go in. This is what we have a president for, to make these hard decisions. And then the bully pulpit, the My Fellow American speech, is there where you explain why you had to do it and make the tough choices. We don't elect the president to go with the political winds, to make the hard choices.
And in terms of the funding for this, we have this bill before Congress for the $500 million mm-hmm. Dollars potentially to arm the moderates in Syria. Where exactly is that money going to be channeled? Because, of course, it is very, very difficult to work out exactly who is moderate and mm-hmm. who it would be best to arm, and also what the consequences of that might be long term.
Yeah, well, first of all, you never know what the consequences are in the end, because you never know where those arms ended up. I don't think anybody that was arming the new Iraqi military thought that they would see those weapons in the hands of ISIS in the end. But I think, first of all, it needs to go through some entity, you know, whether it's a nation or a collective group of nations in the region that can vet who gets these weapons, can control the distribution. It would probably be very difficult for us to do it directly. And I think having someone to move the weapons through that has maybe better understanding of who's getting them and how they're being employed is key. I mean, we did this in Afghanistan, during the Charlie Wilson's war, the first Afghan war. We were very careful about the kinds of weapon systems. We controlled the air defense weapons and that sort of thing very strictly. So there would have to be some degree of control. You know, for example, if they were given, shoulder fire to air defense systems, they could not get another one until they returned the used a portion of the one they use. So there's nobody stockpiling this or selling it. Those are your concerns falling into the wrong hands. So there has to be a vetting process on the ground, which is usually what you do if you have a trusted agent who understands the ground rules and who's getting these weapons and how they're using them.
Can I just talk about the idea of potentially stretching American resources as well? Because President Obama, earlier on in his presidency, talked a lot about pivoting to Asia. We know 60% of naval resources going to that theater by 2020. Meanwhile, of course, we've got Russia, as you've mentioned, President Putin, the Ukraine threat, pivoting more NATO resources there. Then we've also now got ISIS. How on earth can a military, which is also cutting its budget, deal with those three huge issues, let alone other things which may pop up as well?
Well, and I would add, even our own southern hemisphere and our southern border is coming to people are quite, whether the military be deployed there, the National Guard, obviously there's a constant drug war going on down there with strange military assets to a degree. I think it was a big mistake to say that our priority now is in the Pacific. First of all, it denies the globalized world we live in. There are no more regional powers. If you look at a China or somebody like that, their reach is global. Their dependencies are global. Their political influence is global. Their economic trade is global. We may have to execute a strategy on a regional basis just because of span of control, but we need a global strategy, not a set of regional strategies that are exclusive or prioritized. The fastest growing economies in the world right now are in Africa. Europe has always been a traditional ally, and as much as Donald Rumsfeld said old Europe, we're suddenly seeing the importance of old Europe right now with this Ukrainian situation. Our own hemisphere has never been given the attention it should be given, particularly our southern part of our hemisphere, and that's coming home to roost with us right now. The Pacific is important. There are powerhouse economies out there. We've always been a two-ocean nation where our interests lie, and so our influence would be there. But to say you're shifting in some way. And then moving military forces is not a statement. That's not a strategy. The military is one small portion of the strategy. We over-rely on our military. We have an over-militarized foreign policy. The only way we express our prioritization is by shifting a naval power and setting up a base in Darwin, Australia. I mean, it's ludicrous.
Well, the over-relying on the military is something that clearly President Obama with his West Point speech, was trying to move away from. So that's perhaps something he would agree
yep,
with you.
But it's not worked, because if you're going to move away from it, it means the other elements of power, meaning the other elements of government, have to be given the resources. They have to change the way they do business. I mean, culturally change. There's not a planning culture. There's not the scale and scope to deal things with a national level. We saw this in Iraq and Afghanistan. The military ends up working in the other areas, economic development, political development, social programs, and we find the military overwhelmingly there stuck with the job because State Department, USAID, Department of Agriculture, all the other elements you'd bring into this do not have the personnel, the resources, the capacity, the planning culture to deal with all this.
How key do you think the decision to go into Iraq was in terms of the, I think the William Hague, the former Foreign Secretary in the UK, called it systematic disorder now that we have in
yes.
the world. How linked are they? And if you were, and I know this is slightly counterfactual, mm-hmm. if you were President Bush back in 2001, how would you have dealt with the situation in a way which hopefully wouldn't have led to
well, you know, first of all, Iraq was Saddam was contained. I don't think you get an argument from anybody in the region that felt that way. I mean, when I left CENTCOM in 2000, no one was afraid of Saddam. We were containing him at very low cost. As I said, the Saudis and the Kuwaitis were contributing to the no-fly, no-drive maritime intercept operations, which were done with moderate commitment of forces and expenditure on our part. It was under a UN resolution, so it had international legitimacy. Today, I'm waiting for this UN resolution that I think most nations are going to need to be part of a coalition. Iraq was the wrong war, wrong place, wrong time. Our business was with al-Qaeda. And when we went in, we did it in the wrong way because of the distraction of Iraq. Al-Qaeda got away, ran into Pakistan. We then elected to stay in Afghanistan and then elected to adopt this counterinsurgency strategy, which really equals nation building. And then we found ourselves not willing to commit to what it would take to rebuild that nation because the treasure expenditure, the casualties, the military commitment, even by General Petraeus's own manual, we didn't have that commitment. So we adopted a strategy that we couldn't pay for in many respects. And we got stuck in that strategy because we started off the wrong way. And then we adopted the same strategy in Iraq. It wasn't the liberation and the flowers in the street. And yet we were going to, now we were stuck with it. It's the pottery barn, you know, theory that Colin Powell speaks of. You break it, you own it. And we had two breakages. I have a grandson that's banned from Pottery Barn, so I know how that works, and you own a lot of broken pieces.
So what lessons then, 13 years on, can we learn from that, and can President Obama take from that experience moving forward in dealing with ISIS and with the terror yeah. threat?
Well, there's a whole set of lessons learned. I mean, you know, after all these things that are bad experiences, we have the syndrome. You have the Vietnam syndrome, the Somalia syndrome. Now you're going to have the Iraq syndrome. And you can hear this expressed by, oh, no boots on the ground, no mission creep, no, you know, we keep relearning the same lessons. The first lesson is have a strategy, you know, do the analysis, understand what you're up against, have a strategy, use whole of government, all the elements of power, get international legitimacy in what you do, UN resolution, whatever it takes, build viable coalitions, the more flags, the better. Everybody contributes in one form or another. Everybody can't, you know, send brigades in. And then, you know, understand where you want the end state to be. If you can't see the end state, find a very effective and stable way to contain. You know, we contained the Soviet Union for half a century. We deterred and contained. That was our strategy. We contained Saddam for a decade. That's where you might have to go if you can't see a clear end state. During that containment, you ought to be working toward, you know, what that end state might be.
General Anthony Zinni talking there to FSN's Washington correspondent Lorna Shaddock. His book, Before the First Shots Are Fired, How America Can Win or Lose Off the Battlefield, is published by Palgrave Macmillan. Tomorrow we'll have full reaction to the president's speech. But that's FSN Reports for this Wednesday. I'm Simon Marks. For everyone with FSN Everywhere, thanks for listening. Goodbye from Washington.